From New Mexico to West Virginia, Alabama to Minnesota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in an effort to focus funding on actual research, the National Institutes of Health are putting a limit on grant administrative costs. Jay Green from the Heritage Foundation is here with details. With the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act set to expire later this year, tax policy is taking center stage in Congress. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, is a government agency outside the control of either Congress or the President. But the DOGE acts may put it out of business, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And as that Department of Government Efficiency gets down to work, it can get some good ideas from similar efforts in the states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Some institutions are spending up to 60% of research grant funding on administrative costs. An effort by the National Institutes of Health to put an end to that practice has kicked up a firestorm. To sift through the details, we turn to Jay Green of the Heritage Foundation. He is Senior Research Fellow in the Center for Education Policy at Heritage. Jay, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jay, for those in our audience who have not heard of this issue, the National Institutes for Health, there's been an effort by DOGE, by the Department of Government Efficiency, to dial back on a lot of administrative costs. It's kicked up quite an uproar. First of all, explain to us what these grants are and what they are intended for.
The National Institute for Health provides about $35 billion in funding for biomedical research. And this can be some important stuff that includes research in basic science, as well as research that ultimately yields innovations in pharmaceutical products or surgical procedures. And so it's something that has generally been popular. So the question isn't, do we want research to improve medical science? The question is, how much overhead do universities require for conducting that research? And what are the dangers of giving them too much overhead? And what bad things might they do with that extra money? So that, I think, is the issue in dispute. And the NIH, in an order that they issued at the end of last week, said that they would be capping the overhead rate on the research they fund at 15%. So that for every dollar they spend on the research, only an additional 15 cents would go to cover overhead. Currently, most leading universities charge 60 cents for their overhead rate. And so the NIH ruling that came out at the end of the week would cut that down to one quarter of that amount.
I would venture to say that most of us, Jay, if we are making a charitable contribution, whether it be to the Red Cross or Samaritan's Purse or whomever, that we would want more of our donation to go to actually the cause as opposed to overhead. So how do these universities justify an administrative rate of that percentage?
They wave their hands and say, well, you know, research requires buildings and it requires labs and it requires electricity. All of which is true. The question is, how much does all of that cost? And universities are supposed to engage in an accounting endeavor where they add up all their overhead, and then they're supposed to negotiate this rate with the government. The trouble is that they've been negotiating essentially with their best friend for decades, who doesn't bother to haggle with them. So they have figured out clever accounting ways to add more and more expenses into what they call overhead, and then they negotiate with their friends who don't challenge them, and the rate has gone up and up and up. So immediately following World War II, the overhead rate was 8%, but it has now crept up so that at places like Harvard or MIT, it's approaching 70%.
taking a look at this, then, if we were to compare grants that were given to universities and research facilities, Jay, from the private sector, do private sector grants also reimburse at 60%?
The taxpayer is the only sucker willing to pay this rate of overhead. No one else pays. Private foundations that also fund research grants in biomedical science, they pay overhead sometimes, but they pay a much lower rate. The range of overhead paid by private foundations is between 0% and 15%. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, pays 15% overhead on their grants. The Open Society Foundation, funded by George Soros, pays 15 cents. The Walton Family Foundation pays zero. And universities take the grants. They're happy to take them, but they charge taxpayers 60 cents on the dollar when Bill Gates pays 15% on the dollar. Another problem here is that the rate not only has gone up over time as universities have already built out their research infrastructure, but interestingly, the universities that have more research grants charge a higher rate than the universities with fewer research grants, which makes no sense. There should be economies of scale so that the more research a university has, that should spread the fixed cost of having a research infrastructure over a larger base so that their rate should be lower. But instead, their rate is higher. Similarly, over time, as funding for research has gone up from the federal government, instead of having the overhead rate go down, it's gone up. So we have the opposite of economies of scale, which, again, is strong indication that we're seeing accounting shenanigans and not actual cost in these overhead rates.
Jay, there has ensued a great yelling and screaming and whining and rending of garments over all of this. But at the end of the day, if your real goal and your real concern was to bring about advances in medical science and medical technology as rapidly as you can, wouldn't cutting back on overhead costs and putting more into core research be an admirable goal rather than something that you're running to the courts to try to stop?
That's exactly right. And in fact, a number of media outlets have completely misreported what is happening. They've described it as a cut in funding for research. It is not. It's a cut in funding for overhead. The only people who are really unhappy about this should be the administrators who are having their slush funds taken away. Researchers themselves will have more money available for their activities, and the end consumers of that research, the beneficiaries of innovations in medical science, will benefit because there will actually be more money available for the research and less for overhead. The only fig leaf that the universities have in decrying this is their claim that they absolutely need that overhead to be able to produce any research, and they shouldn't expect taxpayers to pay for every last penny of the cost of research overhead for them to conduct that research. They should conduct that research even if we paid them nothing.
Jay Green is a senior research fellow at the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jay, we do have folks from Heritage on our show quite often, but tell us a little bit about Heritage.
The Heritage Foundation is a think tank based in D.C. It's been around for several decades now, and it is a leading conservative voice in America and plays a significant part in helping steer the direction of federal policy, but also is increasingly active in state policy as well.
And the website for the Heritage Foundation would be?
It's www.heritage.org.
Jay Green of the Heritage Foundation. Jay, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
As we typically do, we're going to check in now with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman.
As we're all staring down the barrel of April 15th and Tax Day, Scott, a lot of focus is being placed on tax policy, what's happening in Congress. We have the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act slated to expire later this year. A lot of maneuvering. Want to fill us in, first of all, a bit of history as to how we got to where we are.
It almost goes all the way back to the Bush 2001 and 2003 tax cuts. We've been doing tax policy through budget process known as reconciliation, and that basically means that the tax cuts can't have a deficit impact outside of 10 years on a static basis, meaning if you don't take into consideration the growth that you get from revenues and from these pro-growth ideas that are ultimately allowing people to reinvest and increase productivity and the number of jobs that they've got and wages for workers. All those macroeconomic effects make a big difference. But CBO, when they score the tax legislation, they haven't been using the dynamic effects of tax policy. And in 2017, CBO is basically Congress's scorekeeper. They're the Congressional Budget Office. And their projections are really, really important to the members of Congress. But the problem with their projections is that they're merely estimates. And quite often, they're far off the base in terms of accuracy. For example, in 2017, CBO projected that the annual revenues for this year, 2025, would total $4.7 trillion. But 8 years later, CBO's projection for 2025 is that we're going to collect $5.163 trillion. And while this might sound like Washington math and what's going on here, that's $443 billion annually that CBO was off the mark from their initial projection. And coincidentally, we had these, 2017 tax cuts that on the static score totaled $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And that's not too much when you're thinking about collecting, $45, $50 trillion over 10 years. It's actually a pretty minimal tax cut. The Democrats have done a good job, to their credit, of demagoguing Republicans of trying to cut taxes for the wealthy. But we know in reality that tax policy affects working class families more than anyone. And these taxes in particular that are about to expire happen to coincidentally cost about $4.5 trillion over the next 10 years. And so just based off of CBO's inaccuracy from their revenue projections on the 2017 tax cuts, we would be about made whole if we had true and accurate accounting of the revenues and as they pertain to growth and economic activity. Then when you take a look at federal spending, in 2017, CBO projected that we would be spending $5.967 trillion in 2025. But the most recent projection, 8 years later, was that we're going to be spending $7.028 trillion. Well, that's over $1 trillion. That's $1.06 trillion that they were off in their spending estimate. So the problem with CBO is that they basically have bias against the productivity and the effect of revenues as it comes to tax cuts. And then on the opposite side, they always underestimate how much we're going to have for federal spending. And that's, I think, why, and a big reason why, we have multi-trillion dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. Elon Musk and the Doge Commission have set out a robust and ambitious goal of cutting $2 trillion annually. But as we consider the budget markup and the reconciliation instructions that Congress is working on right now, they're having a hard time coming up with $2 trillion over 10 years in spending cuts. So notwithstanding the high levels of inflation that we've had and the way that the COVID spending got baked into the baseline by Democrats, we think that there's a good solution right now. And number one, you can look, this is going to sound kind of funny to you, Loman, but you can look to the precedent established by President Obama in 2013 when he was faced with a similar dilemma over how to deal with the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts expiring. And he utilized a current policy baseline, which basically assumed on a budgetary assumption that the tax cuts were not expiring, and that would shutter the concern over the deficit impact of a tax cut extension. So when I think about what's going to happen on current policy today in 2025, if nothing happens, my taxes go up. If the tax cuts get extended, my taxes stay the same. That's not really a tax cut. So we need to make sure we're avoiding the largest tax increase in our nation's history. And I think that starts with assuming this current policy baseline And then we can start to get to some of the other big, important campaign promises that Donald Trump made on the campaign trail, like no tax on tips and reducing taxation of senior citizens.
No doubt the president is moving quickly, sort of shock and awe. The left is in shock and we're in awe. We appreciate all of that. And we're going to keep track of it with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a bit about the club, please.
Club for Growth is based in Washington, D.C. We have over 525,000 members from all over the country. In fact, you can sign up and become a member for free at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, is an anomaly, an agency outside the control of either Congress or the president. It may, however, soon cease to exist, as we learn now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Since at least the days of the ancient Greeks, humans have known that one way to write a compelling story is to include a bit of hamartia. That's a tragic flaw. And sometimes that flaw is a physical shortcoming. Achilles had that famously vulnerable heel. But it's often more interesting if the flaw is something more innate, something tied to a character's understanding of themselves. Hubris is the famous one. It's excessive pride. After all, it wasn't really Achilles' unprotected heel that took him down. It was his false belief that his mother had made him invulnerable. No, you haven't stumbled upon a podcast about ancient Greek mythology or storytelling. This is actually a story about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, I'm taking a closer look at some moves that the Trump administration has made, including trying to defund the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, which was, of course, created back in 2010. You might say that it was that same sense of hubris, that same excessive pride, that belief in its invulnerability that has actually caused the CFPB's fatal flaw to become exposed and now taken advantage of by the Trump administration. And the CFPB could now be headed into a sort of coma later this year because of a fatal flaw that was embedded by its own parents, Senator Elizabeth Warren and former President Barack Obama. Let me explain. Unlike every other department and agency within the federal government, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is not funded with congressional appropriations. Instead, its funding flows directly from the Federal Reserve. Every year, the White House submits a budget to the Federal Reserve, and the central bank hands over the necessary amount of cash to keep the bureau running. Last year, it was just about $730 million. For a long time after the CFPB was created, there were some serious questions about the constitutionality of that structure. Those questions were finally resolved for good last year when the Supreme Court ruled that Congress was within its power to offload the purse strings like it did in creating the CFPB, to just give the White House the ability to get those get the funds straight from the Federal Reserve. So funding the CFPB in this way, without any sort of congressional oversight, is not unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court. It's just unorthodox, and I think kind of foolish. Now, here's where the hubris enters the story. When Warren and Obama created the CFPB, they designed that weird, unorthodox funding structure specifically to prevent a future Republican-led Congress from trying to defund the Bureau. Remember, this is 2010. This was the age when Republicans were running around the country telling voters that they intended to repeal Obamacare. They were going to actually cut government. A lot of that never actually materialized, but that's what Republicans were saying. And so Warren and Obama tried to isolate the CFPB from Congress's budgetary powers to prevent that sort of thing from happening. Warren was trying to make it invulnerable to attack, but instead, she just gave it a fatal flaw. Earlier this week, the Trump administration submitted its new funding request for the CFPB to the Federal Reserve, and it asked for $0. Russ Voigt, the director of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, posted on Twitter on Saturday night to explain that he had notified the Federal Reserve that the CFPB will not be taking its next draw of appropriated funding because it is not reasonably necessary to carry out its duties. He added that the Bureau's current balance of about $700 million is in fact excessive in the current fiscal environment, and he concluded by saying that this spigot long contributing to the CFPB's unaccountability, is now being turned off. So that's that. That's game over. That's the end of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, at least for now, at least until a Democrat occupies the White House again. Trump will need an act of Congress if he seriously wants to abolish the Department of Education or other parts of the federal bureaucracy. Even minor spending cuts that have been proposed by the Department of Government Efficiency and other parts of the Trump administration will probably need congressional or legal consent if they're going to be permanent. But there's no serious question about whether the president can unilaterally defund the CFPB. Congress has no role to play in that fight by design. Like Thetis, that's Achilles' mother, dipping her infant son in the river Styx to grant him near invulnerability, except for that heel that she was holding, Warren thought she was making the CFPB an unstoppable force. Instead, all she's done is leave its fate in the hands of President Donald Trump rather than Congress. Now, this analogy is admittedly one that breaks down a bit because the CFPB is really no epic hero. In the time that it's been around, it has reduced access to credit cards for some lower-income consumers and jacked up bank fees and mortgage costs. The bureaucrats at the CFPB have tried to set price controls and passed all sorts of regulations. And, you know, for reasons that Reason and other publications have explored for years, it's really kind of an unnecessary appendage within the federal government. And of course, in its absence, governmental functions that protect consumers from financial crimes will continue. The Department of Justice will still prosecute fraud. The U.S. Treasury will still regulate financial institutions. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that's the FDIC, that will continue to underwrite bank accounts and provide insurance for deposits. And various other state and federal entities will still continue to keep a watch on financial crimes. The CFPB's demise, which is probably only a temporary one anyway, is hardly worth worrying about and certainly not worth mourning. But there's a lesson in all of this for Republicans, too. Power is fleeting and the political dynamics are always shifting. The CFPB was born in an era when Democrats falsely believed that their electoral majority, in presidential elections at least, would only become more dominant in the years after Obama. They were very wrong about that. Republicans are now in something of a similar moment, despite having a minuscule congressional majority and a president who got votes from less than a quarter of all Americans. So Republicans should be careful to avoid these types of mistakes, of course, because excessive pride always comes before the fall. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and everything else going on in the new Trump administration at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The states can help provide a roadmap for the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency. So says Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Donald Trump has promised to drain the swamp and reform the federal government. This commonsensical goal resonated with hardworking Americans tired of bureaucratic inefficiency and rising national debt. In his second term, efforts like the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, with support from private sector leaders like Elon Musk, are pursuing efforts to reduce wasteful spending. These efforts are building momentum in Washington, D.C., and states are realizing the opportunity to also engage in this effort. That's why we just launched the ALEC Government Efficiency Coalition to bring together reform-minded members of Congress with state leaders to develop real solutions to our problems. States have long developed good solutions with cost-cutting measures that provide valuable lessons for the DOGE effort. One major difference between the states and Washington, D.C., of course, is that 49 states, all but Vermont, are required by law to balance their budgets in some way. This mandate forces states to practice fiscal discipline, unlike the federal government, where the national debt has reached a staggering $36.4 trillion, and that amounts to over $323,000 for every taxpayer in America. A standout example of a state-level cost-cutting effort came in 2003 when Washington State, under then-Democrat Governor Gary Locke, faced a $2.4 billion deficit. The state closed that gap without raising taxes by really abandoning the traditional cost-plus budgeting approach, which simply adds a set percentage to the previous year's spending. Instead, Washington adopted priority-based budgeting on a bipartisan basis, where government programs were ranked based on their importance and how well they aligned with key goals of the state. Before this process, their state agencies didn't even have mission statements to outline what their objectives were and how to define success. Priority-based budgeting asks the fundamental questions of good government, such as, what is the role of government? What are the essential services government must provide to fulfill its purpose? How do we know if government's doing a good job? What should all of it cost? And when cuts must be made, how will they be properly prioritized? This approach allowed Washington to balance its budget while focusing on essential government functions, offering a model for both other states and the federal government to emulate. While priority-based budgeting tackles government spending from the top down, other state initiatives focus on ensuring that established programs are still necessary. One of the central criticisms of government is that once programs and agencies are created, they rarely face reevaluation and proper scrutiny. As economist Milton Friedman famously said, nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program. To address this issue, Texas created the Sunset Advisory Commission in 1977, which is tasked with periodically reviewing government programs and eliminating those that are no longer effective or necessary. Under this system, agencies are automatically abolished unless the legislature passes a continuation bill, typically limited to 12 years. Over the years, the commission has saved Texas billions by eliminating or consolidating agencies. For every dollar spent on the commission, Texas has saved a reported $27, demonstrating that ongoing evaluation is essential to keeping government lean and efficient. Another often overlooked aspect of government efficiency is understanding the true cost of government services. For instance, how much does it cost to plow a mile of snow or pave a mile of highway? Though these might seem as minor questions, large bureaucracies tend not to consider every cost involved in such services, and identifying the hidden costs can lead to large savings. Another vital question about government is property on its balance sheet. What does the government own and how much is it worth? Many government agencies at the federal, state, and local levels do not maintain clear records of their assets or how to value them. And the push for government efficiency led by President Trump is gaining traction as we face the gravity of our overwhelming $36 trillion of national debt. By looking to the states for successful ideas of taxpayer savings, the federal government can adopt proven strategies to reduce waste, improve accountability, and ultimately save taxpayers money. As the DOGE effort continues to gain momentum, it is inspiring a new wave of state-level innovation and idea generation on budget reform. The key takeaway is that common-sense solutions to overspending and waste are not only possible, they are already being implemented by the states, and the federal government can benefit from taking these tested solutions and putting them into action. For more information, you can go to alec.org/AGE or AGE to join our ALEC Government Efficiency Coalition. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBSS-AM and WMGM-FM in Linwood, New Jersey, along with WHAI-FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.